Kate, might we start by you telling me what it is about the hummingbird that's so astonishing?
So, one of the things about the hummingbird is that it is iridescent, which the word comes from the Greek iris, meaning rainbow, and essent, meaning having a tendency towards, so creatures with a tendency towards rainbows, and they change colour in different lights. And the male bee hummingbird, which is the smallest of hummingbirds, which has wings that grow to 3 centimetres across and is incubated in a tiny egg for 18 days the size of a chickpea. Yet when it is hatched and when it flies, its wings beat so fast that it is, of course, one of the ones that led to the name hummingbird. They're humbird because of the name that their wings made. They appear to sing as they move. And that element of iridescence, that is one of the things that I have always been fascinated by. Iridescence, where you can shift colour. And in almost all creatures, iridescence has a purpose. So hummingbirds use it largely as a form of a mating ritual. Like the Rofu hummingbird, it has a beautiful sort of plumage in the neck that shifts from orange to red to yellow as it dives in front of the female. And the Morpheus butterfly has iridescent wings, which we think they are using to signal meaning across distances, one butterfly to another. And there is only one iridescent mammal, and it's the golden mole, which is not really a mole in the way of these things. And it is silver and yellow and brown, but under light it turns red and purple and blue and gold. And almost all creatures in the world that are iridescent for a reason. But the golden mole lives underground and is blind. So the golden mole, the only iridescent mammal, has never seen its own beauty. And that iridescence is a byproduct of evolution. It's because their fur was designed to be particularly hard-wearing for the burrowing they do. And it's just beauty thrown up without purpose by the slowly turning world. And is, I think, worth remembering. When I was writing about animals, which I've been doing for a bit less than a decade now, that thing that nothing turns out to be more simple than we thought. It is always more complicated, more beautiful, more strange, more unexpected, and that the world in its turning keeps throwing up these beauties. It hasn't stopped, if only we can leave it alone enough for it to continue to do so.
So I think I'm going to be lost for words now for the next sort of 15 minutes. You're someone who is very self-evidently feels these passions and a wonder deeply. Has that always been true of you?
I think it's something, yes. I think the book that I wrote, The Golden Mole, it steals from G.J. Chesterton the quote, "The world will never starve for want of wonders, but only for want of wonder." And I have been more and more interested in the last few years about the idea of wonder and awe and attention as political galvanic stances rather than something passive. Wonder that is not just us standing alone in a field thinking of adjectives for a heron, that is something bolder than that, and that something that has a kind of galvanism and a kind of politics and active element to it. And of course, the flip side of it is, as we have discussed, wonder, our love, is not always harmless. Mm. Often we, in our love, are most able to destroy, particularly the living world. And I think this, of course, is on a continuum from us flying to the Galapagos to see the tortoises and thereby bringing about much greater certainty their end. But if you take it to its furthest extreme, there is a thing that I didn't know about until very recently, but I imagine some people here do, which is extinction speculation.
Okay, before you come on to extinction speculation, just the hummingbird, what happened to it? So this is interesting. This is really interesting to me. So there we are, Victorian England.
Yeah.
Suddenly, they're all the rage. beautiful in the way you've described, a shared sense of rapture around their beauty. What happened afterwards?
So this is, again, an example of where our wonder is connected to our love, is connected to our covetousness, is connected to our appetite, is connected to our greed, is connected to our destruction. Because people went hummingbird mad. Queen Victoria saw them at the Great Exhibition, and she said that she had never seen anything so lovely. Ruskin thought if he had seen one when he was younger, he might have changed his entire life and become something better. He doesn't specify what. But we started using hummingbirds such that in one day at an auction house, hummingbirds being sold to milliners were sold in the number of 400,000 dead birds imported from South America. People used them for little brooches. You could have a whole hummingbird head as your buttons all the way down your blouse. And there were instructions given in the weekly women's magazines of how you could arrange your hummingbird on your hat brim so that it had a pleasing and startled expression, as if it just like dropped down from the sky onto your bird hat. And so it was one of those intersections of the ways in which we see something and adore it, but our adoration is not always to be trusted.
And that's my, I guess, so some years ago we had a Medicine on Box themed wonder, and we, you know, it's almost, if I may, you know, hip to incite people to wonder. And rightly, and really important we come on to the political arm of that. But it's challenging to inhabit in a way that is, I fear, truthful or such that the sail is pointing where we want it to be, and so readily open to corruption, or maybe not corruption, flipping into gluttony, desire, in many instances. And I'd love to hear about extinction speculation, but arguably the entire colonial project, the male gaze, there's all sorts of challenges around how we apprehend beauty and act with it.
The colonial project, I think, exactly being the furthest extreme of that, of a system of dominance and extraction, which had in it often the language of love. And of course, so something like extinction speculation is based on the knowledge of our passion for that which is rare, which is often bound up with our sense of wonder. I think one of the more political angles of wonder might be, how do we return to astonishment for that which is common? How do we make people see that, you know, the sort of peculiarity and strangeness of the hedgehog and the pigeon? But briefly, extinction speculation at the furthest extreme is the practice of hoarding that which is close to extinct in the hope that when extinction comes, the value of your hoard will skyrocket. So the Mitsubishi conglomerate, the same one that made like all our televisions in the 90s, they own 40% of the world's wild bluefin tuna that they are keeping in minus 60 degree sort of aircraft hangars, the expectation, presumably, that when it becomes extinct in the wild, that value will increase. It's specifically rhinos and bear bladders and tigers. And it has led to things like the extinction in the wild of the Caspian tiger, which was the tiger with perhaps the softest of fur. The South China tiger hasn't been seen in the wild since the 1980s. And those who collect rhino horn are paying poachers to shoot and kill rhinos without harvestable horns, simply to hurry along the final death. Extinction is not just born of our inertia, it is also incentive-driven. And I think that that is one of the things that we have to hold in our hand. When we think about the beauty of the world, we have to think also about the fact that there are those who sit as the world in its majesty turns, waiting with eager hunger for the end to come. I think you can't imagine a world which doesn't also encompass that knowledge.
And I, you know, as you've presented it there, it almost feels too easy for us to be speculating and asking for wonder at the same time as being conscious of these very problematic appetites, and also in a world of very deep suffering. Sometimes I fear it's, you know, almost being trivial. So we'll come on, look at this and feel something. And whether it's almost more accessible to those from a position of privilege. Which is why I just wonder if we could move on to then this other really important facet of your thought. The person of John Donne inhabited, lived in a time, and indeed his own life, was surrounded within a circumference of quite a lot of suffering and distress and discomfort and a lack of privilege, yet he epitomised the drive towards genuine wonder. And if you could
exactly
tell us about
that.
Him, yeah.
So that is why I love him. That is the one reason that I spent a decade of my life thinking about John Donne. That and that he was incredibly good looking. But Donne lived at a time, born in 1572, at which to be Catholic was to be persecuted. He probably saw his great uncle hung, drawn, and quartered. He understood sorrow in a way that went to the bone. He had his younger brother, who was his specific duty to care for. Under his care, his younger brother was arrested for harboring a priest, thrown in jail, and died alone and unvisited of the plague. Donne himself went to war and saw young soldiers burning to death leap into the ocean. He was suicidal his entire life, and he wrote the first full-length treatise on suicide in the English language. He married and then lost 6 children. He lost his wife and childbirth, which was, of course, in part his fault. He wrote that he felt the pull of his own sword daily. He was a man for whom despair was a deep and intimate companion. He walked alongside despair. And yet, that same man was the one who insisted with more dogged clarity than almost any other writer I can find in the English language on awe, on astonishment, on the passionate meeting of human heart to human heart, on the power of sex, on... He believed us to be fundamentally a miracle, but like a disastrous miracle. He said, you know, only man of all envenomed things works upon itself with inborn sting. And yet, he said of sex, this ecstasy doth unperplex. The idea that sex might be a kind of semaphore for the human living infinite. He said, compared unto the world, it is too little a thing to call a man a little world, because compared unto the world itself is a dwarf. There is nothing greater than the human imagination. He had the sense of us as, you know, tap a human and they ring with the sound of infinity. And often in quite radical ways, he was at a time when there were people in the pulpit saying, laughter is forbidden. But he stood up in the pulpit and said, not to laugh, that is a stupidity, that is a contempt. And so someone who could hold these two extremes in the same hand, dread and knowledge of what it was to be spiteful and cruel and a failure, and also to say, it is an astonishment, and it therefore behoves you daily to be astonished. I find that galvanic.
And there's a time, isn't there, where what struck me in reading your writing about him, his description of someone destined to execution moving on their way between the jail and his executioner. I can't remember
exactly. So he says, he's in one of his later sermons, he gets harsher and harsher as he gets older, which I think is one of the reasons that the fact that the sense of the miraculous remains, I think, is so striking. He says, never does any man sleep between Newgate and Tyburn. Newgate, the place of imprisonment, and Tyburn, the place of execution. And yet we are known to sleep one's whole life through. Never is any man thoroughly awake. Awake! And that, I think, is Donne's sense of what it is that we owe to the world. That wakenedness. Donne's poetry, I teach it at Oxford, is famously difficult, and my students very understandably find it so. But the thing I always tell them is, that's on purpose. Why should it be easy? Everything worth doing tends to be hard. And if you work hard enough at the poetry, it unfurls for you. It is like cracking a safe. And I think he felt that you should bring the full focus of your human intellect to your days. You know, he said he had this immoderate, hydroptic thirst of learning. And I think that's something that I always want my students to remember.
And it's interesting, isn't it? Because I've already confessed to struggling with the poetry, and I'm sorry. but I just wonder if there is also an element of the more attention you allow yourself, demand of yourself, to pay to a thing, such as you and Dunn, there's almost the capacity to reap love there, isn't it? We live in a world that expects instantaneous wonder, awe, and love. But in fact, this is something that's garnered through attention and reverence and care.
Exactly that. So I think Dunn both demands attention. Literally, in his words, he says attention. But also is proof positive that attention given over time and with a certain amount of ruthlessness to your own comfort, he's hard, learning about him is hard, learning the Latin is hard. In exchange, what you get is love. And I think that, like, to dial back to the wonder idea, how can you remain astonished? How can we remain in wonder of the familiar? It's not really possible. That becomes a bit fake. And often when we talk about wonder, it has the preface childlike, as if you have to disavow some of your adult sophistication to invest in wonder. But I think Dunn perhaps points to the idea that there is a way to remain perpetually, politically astonished, and it is just learning.
Can you say a bit more for me about what you mean by attention and love as a political act? And if you're comfortable, to the extent that also is shaped in any sense by your sense of faith?
I think, faced with the world as it is now, you know, what can we do? I don't know, but it seems to me that if we refuse to acquiesce in those powers who would have us look away and ignore the destruction of the finest known thing in existence, the living world, the earth that we stand on, if we were to put our attention as a countermanding force to those who would have us look away. And that ranges from politicians and the very obvious, you know, head of oil companies, but also those who would have us instead lay down our hopes elsewhere, sort of a capitalist enterprise. That seems to me a passionate form of love, and for me personally is profoundly bound up with a sense of religious faith, that might be the thing that we owe God, because it is at its heart a form of love. And I think I'm a scholar by training, and also just by, you know, before you're a scholar, when you're a kid, they call it being a dork. I do believe in the power of knowledge and of learning and of perpetual learning, of hope as a discipline and learning as a discipline, and the two are very, very closely connected to me. I think our hope from now on, there's no point in sitting in a room being hopeful. We are going to have to be active in our hope. Our hope is going to have to be a political active gesture rather than just a private one, I think.
And entirely attached to action, right, which begins in attention.
Yeah, and to each other. Like Einstein said, this idea that what we will need is to widen our sense of what deserves our compassion and our empathy, which is both something I think that we learn from looking at the natural world with true attention and focus, and also what John Donne would have us do, I think.
I just wondered in the last minute whether there's a really, many people will be familiar with bits of this passage where he speaks to our connectedness. Yeah. Do you think you might be able to give us that?
So this is the bit you all know of Donne. What you might not know is he wrote it when he thought he was dying. He thought he had 3 days to live. In fact, he lived another 8 years, but he thought he was right at the very end of the precipice. And In those days, the thing he chose to lay out was the sense that we are connected, and you could choose to believe that we are not, but it would be a great stupidity and a great contempt. He said, "No man is an island entire of itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the whole. If a clod be washed away by the sea, Europe is the less, as well as if a promontory were, as well as if some manor house of thine friends or thine own were. Every man's death diminishes me, for I am involved in mankind. Therefore, never send to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee."
Catherine Rundle.
Thank you.